The Guardian.
Hello, I'm Alok Jha, and welcome to Science Weekly. This episode continues our long-running theme of digging deep into the mysteries of the universe. We're speaking to astrophysicist and astronomer Jerry Ostreicher about the missing bits of our cosmos, dark matter and dark energy. His new book, Heart of Darkness, Unraveling the Mysteries of the Invisible Universe, takes in a panoramic view of his field and traces our emerging understanding of the universe over the last several hundred years. He came into The Guardian to expand our minds. So Jerry, can you start by just taking us through where the idea that most of our universe is missing came from? When did physicists realize this?
Well, it's a story with a lot of prehistory. And the problem is that it isn't missing. It's that it's there. When they talked about missing matter, they had it actually exactly the opposite of what it really is. If you get on the scale in the morning and you say, well, I think I weigh about 130. And it says you weigh 160. You say, well, that's rather annoying. And you try another scale and another scale and another scale. And no matter what you do, it always comes out. That's really what happened. When we weighed things in the universe, we got answers that surprised us. So we can weigh the sun by the orbit of the Earth around the sun, and we get a number, 3 times 10 to the 33 grams. If we do the same thing from the orbit of Jupiter, we get the same answer. Everything's okay. Every planet gives us the same answer for the mass of the sun. But when we weighed astronomical objects, we got answers at variance with what we thought. And as we looked at bigger and bigger volumes, we got answers at greater and greater variance. The history is that the pioneer in this was a Swiss astronomer, Fritz Zwicky. And he began his work before I was born. In the 30s, he looked at clusters of galaxies. So these are, you know, the Milky Way is a galaxy. And we're pretty much by ourselves with one companion, Andromeda, which you can see in the winter sky. So they're two galaxies together orbiting each other. Well, there are places in the universe where you can see a cluster of 100 or 1,000 galaxies buzzing around one another. And from their velocities and their separations, you can tell how much mass there is to keep them together. In the same way, we can tell the mass of the sun by the Earth and the planets going around it. Well, he did this using Doppler shift to get the velocities of the different galaxies in the different clusters, like the Coma cluster. And he found a mass for them, which was 10 to the 15 solar masses. So that's a 1 and 15 zeros after it. Well, if you took the light from the galaxies and said it was made up of things like the sun, then if you have a billion solar luminosities, you expect it to be a billion solar masses. And that came out short by a factor of several hundred from the mass he needed to account for the motions.
And you need that mass, otherwise the galaxies would have flown apart.
They just would fly apart. They wouldn't be there in a cluster.
So something's holding them there. In other words, mass of some sort.
Of some sort. It's either ordinary gravity or it's something else. But something is holding the thing together. If you see the bees buzzing around the hive, well, you expect the hive to be there even if you can't see the hive.
And so there's the first hints of something that, you know, later is called, or did he call it dark matter?
He actually called it dark matter.
Right.
I looked it up recently.
Okay.
I've, as you know, written a book on this, and so I checked some of the original sources, and I found that my German isn't very good, but he called it dunkle Materie.
Which is pretty, you know, that says
he
dark
called
matter.
It dark matter.
So he calls this dark matter as a sort of, it's a mystery. That's what it implies. But of course, the mysteries are there to be solved. And so fast forward then, when do scientists start to actually begin to measure the distribution of this and start to think of it as a thing to find?
So why did he call it dark matter? Well, he called it matter because it exerted gravity. And that was the key, that it's something which produces a gravitational force just according to Newton. And no one knew what to make of this. He called it dark because you couldn't see it. and they looked in other circumstances, and then people began to find it around ordinary galaxies. So in the 60s and 70s of the last century, people looked at the rotation curves in galaxies. So a galaxy like ours is rotating, or Andromeda, it's rotating. And just as you can find the mass of the sun by the velocity of the planets around it, so you could find the mass of the galaxy by the velocity of the stars going around the center. So we go around the center of our galaxy at about 200 kilometers per second. And then you could look at other stars which are closer to the center and for others further away, and you'd get the mass. Well, what I mentioned at the beginning is it doesn't matter which planet you use, you get the same mass. That wasn't true when they did this for galaxies. The test particles, the stars they used that were further from the center, got more and more mass. And people, the radio astronomers, the optical astronomers, found more and more mass at larger and larger radii from the nearby galaxies.
So we're detecting more of this stuff using modern instruments because of its gravitational effects of around it. I suppose one simple question might be for people who come to this subject new. If you can't find the cause of the mass of a large cluster of galaxies, could it be things? You say we can't see this stuff, but black holes we can't see either. How come it's not that? And why is it this new sort of substance?
Well, one possibility is that it is black holes, actually. I mean, what you know is it's something that's not absorbing or emitting any light. And people look for the possibility of black holes. So let me tell you a little bit more about the history, because it's fascinating. In the 70s, I looked at this with Jim Peebles in Princeton, and we summarized all the evidence. We didn't do much that was really original. And we concluded that there really was evidence from many different lines, from rotation curves of galaxies, from the clusters, the simplest one is that Andromeda is coming towards us. Why is Andromeda coming towards us? The universe is in general expanding. But if you figure out what the mass has to be for our galaxy and Andromeda, it's much more than you'd have guessed from the light in order to make us approach each other. Well, the National Academy of Sciences had me give a lecture on all of these discoveries, 1975. And afterwards, I was walking the halls, and some elderly gentleman, probably younger than I am today, walked up to me with a big, thick book under his arm. And it was Horace Babcock. I didn't know who Horace Babcock was. He had been the director of Lick Observatory. It was his thesis under his arm, his PhD thesis, written in 1937, in which he concluded from measuring properties of Andromeda that there was a huge amount of matter in that, in the galaxy at large radii. So the fact is, there had been discovery after discovery after discovery. And he was a little surprised that I hadn't mentioned his work, and the truth is I hadn't known of it. I apologize profusely. But many, many, many different lines of evidence have given the same answer. So I mentioned two of them, the clusters and the rotation curves. Another one is gravitational lensing. This was an effect predicted by Einstein and Zwicky. And it works as follows. If there's a massive object and it's between you and a distant object, let's say a quasar, then the light from the quasar can come around that object and be bent, the massive object, and you'll see more than one image of the distant object. And there's enough details in that image so you know it's the same thing by arriving by different paths at you. And it's called gravitational lensing. And you can use the formula that Einstein and Zwicky put together to see what the mass is. And when that was done for galaxies, clusters of galaxies, once again, you found much more mass than you would have expected from just the stars in it, and the same amount of mass as you'd gotten from the orbital arguments. So one of the things that has happened is that people say, well, the problem is not that there's more matter there than we expected, but that Newton's laws aren't quite right, that at large distances from an object, they don't give you the right answer, that there's a little deviation. And so people have invented modified gravity. It's called modified Newtonian gravity, MOND. And the trouble is, you can use that to explain one or another of the phenomenon that you have observed, but not all of them. You can't understand the growth of structure from early times. You can't understand why Andromeda is coming towards us. So people have invented alternate theories to explain one or the other, but you can't explain them all. And it could be, you could get suspicious of it all if one argument gave so much mass and another argument gave you such and such mass, and the different arguments gave you different answers. But the truth is they all give you the same answer.
And so it all points to the same direction, that there is something out there that has feels the effects of gravity, but doesn't feel the effects of the electromagnetic force, hence it's dark. And that's why we can't detect it in the usual way that we detect things in the universe. I mean, it kind of, when looking at it in modern terms, it's, why should we be able to detect the rest of the universe? It's kind of amazing that we have done so far with the instruments that we have. But to take me through then right now what the leading ideas are for what this stuff might be. I mean, I've heard all sorts of things, dead brown dwarfs, stars that, you know, ash, bits of matter that are just floating around. I mean, that sounds kind of very unromantic, but I like to think that there's just these particles streaming through all the time that we just haven't detected yet, a new type of fundamental particle. I mean, where are we in actually nailing some of this stuff down?
So the first thing to suppose is that it's some kind of ordinary matter, and that's what everyone first guessed, that we just haven't found.
The reams of planets or something.
Yeah, that we so can't for detect. Example, it could be low-mass stars. And that was the first thing that people looked for, because the truth is that most of the mass in stars we can't easily see, because in stars which are just too faint. And there were many, many searches for that, and one method detects all of them, and that's again gravitational lensing, micro lensing. You look at some distant source, and then if there's any star that comes up along the line of sight between you and the distant source, you get a flicker when that star, that dark star, goes along the line of sight between you and the distant source. It gets momentarily brighter and then fainter again.
And we can detect this using modern instruments.
Just time. Ordinary telescopes, in fact, the small telescopes are fine. There are lots of amateurs do it. And there is an Ogle experiment doing it, and it's used for finding planets, too. And we did it, and we found that there were lots and lots of low-mass stars, but failing by a factor of 20 to be the right amount. In other words, there was more, a little bit more than we had expected, but it's not, the dark matter isn't that. So then people thought, well, there's gas in some form. And then you could look for the emission from that gas, or you could look for the absorption from that gas. And it would be a long story to say all the different methods that it will use in the radio and the infrared and the x-rays. Everything failed. But there was one overarching argument, which was really simple, which said that it wasn't likely to be any of these things. And that is Big Bang nucleosynthesis. So if you ask where the elements come from, hydrogen, helium, iron, everything, we have put together a picture which is pretty simple and seems to work, that the lightest elements, hydrogen and helium, which are the most abundant, and the little bit of the next lightest ones, lithium, beryllium, and boron, were made in the Big Bang itself. And if that is true, then you can predict what the ratios of the different isotopes would be, how much is the amount of deuterium to hydrogen and lithium and beryllium, et cetera, and all those ratios come out just right. So the new Planck satellite enables you to make very, very detailed predictions, and the predictions for the abundances of the light elements come out right spot on. So we're pretty sure that they were cooked in the Big Bang. But there's one adjustable parameter in the fits, and that is how much matter there is altogether. If you adjust that, then you can predict all the relative abundances of all the different ones. And that number gives an amount for the ordinary matter of all kinds, which is 1/6 of the dark matter, a small fraction. So what that tells you is that if Big Bang nucleosynthesis is right, then there just isn't enough baryons of any form that it could be hidden in to make up the dark matter.
Can you just tell us what baryons are? These are
it's you matter, and me.
You and me, yeah.
The chair,
normal
the
matter,
room, ordinary matter.
Yeah.
Okay, and including not just the ordinary matter we have, but all the exotic matter that you can make in accelerators that decays. So even elements that don't last very long are baryons. So anything made out of nucleons.
But yeah, protons, neutrons, all the things we're familiar with.
Yeah.
So I mean, you say that these things were created at the Big Bang, and then of course the heavier elements are created during the formation of stars and supernovae, etc.
Correct.
All the way up to iron and so on. But that, as you say, doesn't account for everything. And so, what could these other particles be?
Well, there are many different theories, and I am not expert enough in particle physics to tell you which of the ones are more plausible. What we do know is that we can build detectors that would find these particles going through the detectors, bouncing off ordinary matter and giving ordinary matter a kick. The collisions are weak and rare, but nevertheless, if we build a big detector, we'd see the particles moved every now and then. And we've been looking and looking and looking. There are a couple of possible detections, but none of them that pass the scrupulous test that two groups have to find the same thing and each agree that the other one is right.
And never mind the fact that if you do find it, to find any properties, you have to find lots of them to do actual experiments or observations that actually make any sense. Let's assume that dark matter and then us, baryonic matter, that seems like a big enough problem. But of course, that isn't the whole picture, as you've intimated. In fact, dark matter and us is something like 20 or 25% of the mass energy of the universe. And the rest is another huge hole in physics.
Exactly.
Tell me about this.
First of all, on the dark matter, it may not be one thing. That's important to know. Because you mentioned that there could be black holes. Well, there are black holes. And probably a few percent of the dark matter is in this form. We know neutrinos have a mass. So they may contribute a few percent. And so it may turn out, when you do the inventory, that there's one major part and then there's a lot of small parts. So when you ask a neuroscientist, what's the human brain? They'll say, which part are you talking about? Because we've evolved over time and there are many different parts. Well, it may be similar here. There may not be just one substance. Dark energy is even worse.
This is the remaining 75%.
Right. And it's more recent. The ideas... Well, it's both more recent and it's older. So let me go back right to the beginning. There were papers by Einstein very early on. I don't have the exact date, but I think it was 1915, in which he wanted to make a simple model of the universe. It was just done from pure thought. Gravity pulls things together. And so there's a danger that has always been there and actually troubled Newton, that if you have a lot of matter and there's nothing else around, it'll just all collapse into a heap. Einstein knew that there were galaxies out there, but didn't know about the expanding universe. And so the idea that the whole thing would collapse in a great crunch was a bit unnerving to him. And he tried to invent something which would hold it up and keep it from collapsing. So he invented something called the cosmological constant, which was just a number. He called it lambda, put it in his equations, and he was sorry almost immediately. And we have letters from him. He doesn't ever say what's attributed to him, that it was the biggest blunder in his life. But he does feel a bit queasy about this invention. And the idea was, it's a repulsive force that pushes things apart and just balances gravity, which pulls things together.
It's a bit of a bodge.
Yes.
If you can call any of Einstein's work bodge.
But it's actually worse than that. People who knew him said he was a good mathematician, but not a great one. But he was an incredible intuitive physicist. And there's something which is really simple that any first-year graduate student could prove is a problem with his invention of the cosmological constant. And that is the following. If you invent it so that it just balances the force of gravity, so two galaxies have the gravity pulling them together balanced by the cosmological constant pushing them apart. Well, you push them a little further apart, and the cosmological constant gets stronger, gravity gets weaker, and they move further and further apart. If you push them a little closer together, gravity gets stronger, the cosmological constant gets weaker, its force gets weaker, and they collapse. So the universe that he invented would have been totally unstable. And no sooner had he published it was only a couple of years when I believe it was a Russian mathematician, Friedman, proved that his universe was totally unstable. So the cosmological constant was dropped because it was invented for a silly reason. And it was also found that the universe was expanding, and so you didn't need it. And in fact, it had been known that the universe was expanding when he invented it. It's just that the astronomers working in Arizona hadn't talked to the physicists who hadn't talked to, et cetera, et cetera. And so he hadn't known the facts. Well, it was dropped, and then it was sitting around as sort of a tool in the toolbox, which no one wanted to pick up, had a bad reputation. But you couldn't wish it away if Einstein had invented it. And in the 70s, several of us began to look at it again. So Mike Turner in Chicago, Paul Steinhardt and I, Beatrice Tinsley, several different groups began to look and say, suppose we put this back in and we leave the value of it uncertain. Would it make our cosmology better or worse?
But why would they want it back in, given that it didn't work before?
Well, there were a couple of different reasons for thinking of reviving it. One of them was that there is sort of a magic number for the amount of stuff in the universe, which you can write in terms of the Hubble constant. And the amount of stuff, matter and energy, that you had, including even the dark matter, was only about 20%. So suppose you're a religious person and somebody says there's no God. That's all right, maybe. That person is an atheist, and you say there's one God. Someone else says there's an infinite number of gods. But no one wants to say there's 0.236 gods. And it was quite annoying that the amount of stuff in the universe, matter and energy, added up to some fraction, definitely not zero, but definitely less than one. And people kept on looking for ways to make it one, because one of the things about a universe in which is like that, it's geometrically flat and it stays flat. It's always flat. So one simple way of putting it is if you draw a circle, it's always the circumference is always pi times the diameter, no matter when you draw it. Whereas if the universe is not flat, the ratio between the circumference and the diameter changes with time. It's either bigger than pi or smaller than pi, but it's changing all the time. And so it was sort of a magical property of the universe which people wanted for aesthetic reasons, that the total mass and energy in the universe in the critical units would be just unity, omega would be one. And it wasn't, even including the dark matter. So that was one reason, but then there were a number of nitty-gritty reasons. So for example, if you took the standard model of the universe and the standard value of the Hubble constant and the standard stellar evolution theory, you found that a lot of the stars were older than the universe. Not good. It was quite annoying that we seemed to have a universe which was too young compared to the things in it. Well, there are a large number of other more minor problems with the standard, at that time, standard model, which had ordinary matter and dark matter and nothing else. And then there was this aesthetic problem. So what people began to ask are, suppose we tried to make up the rest of the matter, the rest of the energy, matter, density with dark energy. We revive Einstein's constant. Would that be a good model for the universe? So there were papers written, I think, around 1995, I wrote one of them with Paul Steinhardt, but other people did as well. And what was found was that magically all of the problems went away. You could make a simple model universe where everything added up to one in these magic units, where three quarters of it was dark energy, then there was dark matter, then there was ordinary matter. And it seemed to fit all of the observations. Well, included in those observations was the microwave background. It was soon found from WMAP what the fluctuations in the microwave background were, and they fit this model perfectly. And then with subsequent measurements from satellites, and the most recent one is the Planck satellite, they show a fit to a model which includes the cosmological constant and a fit to getting omega of one It's now, its value now is 1.01 plus or minus 0.05 or 0.01 or something like that. In other words, it fits to within about 1%.
Now, it's worth saying the microwave background you mentioned there, that this is the very famous picture that people will have seen. It's this sort of oval picture of the universe with the sort of little fluctuations in color, which are the temperatures of the microwave portion of the universe, i.e. it's just that people call it the imprint of the Big Bang, don't they? And this is important because you mentioned the dark matter was coming back into physics. Dark energy was coming back into physics in the 70s. And it was 20 years later that it finally became a reality when it was discovered that this stuff actually does exist out there somewhere. It's not just a theoretical construct.
So what happened was there were many different arguments for it, just as there were for dark matter. And then when the WMAP satellite looked at the fine structure in the microwave background, it found that it fit perfectly. So this is the residual glowing of the ashes after the Big Bang, which you can see with telescopes in space. And you look at the fine structure and the detail, and you plot it, and you basically fit it with a model. And it comes out with saying that there is dark energy and dark matter, and it all fits and adds up to unity. And so now we're in the situation with the cosmological constant, which is also named dark energy, because it seems to make the universe expand faster and faster, that it's there. Every single test for it gives the same answer. There are new space experiments being planned to get more significant figures, but it seems as if we can't find a solution to cosmology that doesn't have it. And there it is. So now we have two large mysteries. We hope there are no more, because when you add everything up, it is very close to the magic number now. It's within 1%.
Well, the mystery still exists as to what it is, dark energy. We mentioned earlier with dark matter, there might be some candidates and there's an inventory of different things that it might be. But I suppose we get to with dark energy is that this is, I mean, it's even more esoteric. It's an energy. Is it in something in the vacuum? Is it something? Well, what is this stuff that's pushing everything apart?
So the hope had been that it was some mysterious force field of the kind that, like an electromagnetic force, which has a source, let's say electrons and protons produce electromagnetic forces, or like gravity, some force field which would be detectable and would have an origin in some mysterious particles. But we have not been able to find a good theory for it. Quintessence was proposed. The specific ideas haven't borne much fruit.
I don't want to end on a downer because you know there's these huge mysteries left in terms of what the stuff is. We know they're there now. We measured them to exquisite precision, as you've detailed. The next generation of physicists have to work out what this stuff is and how they affect our universe and the future of it. But can I ask, you know, as you pass this baton on to your successors, do you feel like? Do you feel guilty that you created all these problems for them? Or do you, physicists generally tend to get excited when they don't know something.
I think it's tremendously exciting. My guess is the graduate student is around right now, she or he, who will figure it all out and will say, well, you know, it has to be as it is, that string theory can't explain it. Right now, there are, as you know, an incredibly, not quite infinite, but an incredibly large number of different variants of string theory. And the right one, someone will say, but you know, if you impose the following symmetry requirements on the theory, you're only left with three of them, and two of them are excluded for this and that reason. And the last one predicts the dark matter and the dark energy to be exactly what we have.
Is string theory your best hope for this then?
Well, that's one approach. That's the way Einstein did it. He actually just took electrodynamics from Maxwell and dynamics from Newton and put them together to develop relativity with no experiments. Or it could be that the next successes will be experimental. So it either will be some clever graduate student just doing it by pure thought, or it could be that one of the experiments looking for dark matter or one of the experiments looking for the details of dark energy will actually find clues which will help us unravel it. So it couldn't be a more exciting time.
I'll be curious when that does happen to know what the biggest question at that point is in the future, because I think that there's going to be even more. So we should probably leave it there. Jerry, thank you very much for coming in. That's been fascinating.
It's been a great pleasure.
Heart of Darkness, Unraveling the Mysteries of the Invisible Universe by Jerry Ostreicher is published by Alan Lane. That's all we have for you this week. Remember, for breaking science news day and night, just go to guardian.co.uk/science. But from me, Alok Jha, and Science Weekly producer Jason Phipps, it's bye for now. Thanks for listening.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.